Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Genocide Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Jeff Bachman, a senior lecturer at the American University School of International Service and a genocide studies scholar. Thank you all for listening. Today, I'll be talking to Ali Abdullatif Almeida about Genocide in Libya, Shar, A Hidden Colonial History, published by Routledge in 2020. Ali, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jeff, very much.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Can you start us off by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
I am Ali Abdullatif Almeida. I am a professor of political science at the University of New England. I was born in central Libya and educated at Cairo University in Egypt and the University of Washington in the United States. I've been trained and interested in three fields, comparative political theory, historical sociology, and also African history. My work has been focusing on anti-colonial resistance in Northern Africa, particularly Libya. And in the last 15, 20 years, I have been researching a very, very sad case of forgotten genocide in Libya under the Italian fascist regime.
Thank you, Ali. And for our listeners who are a little unfamiliar with the years between 1911 and 1934 in Libya, I know your book focuses even more so on 1929 to 1934, but could you provide a brief overview to contextualize your research?
Yes. My first book has been on the social, cultural, and economic basis of the anti-colonial resistance between late 19th century until the 1932. And the basically, I tried to examine in my first book, The Making of Modern Libya, is the how did Libyan society reacted to Italian colonial conquest in 1911, and how they various reactions could be explained until the end of the colonial period in 1943. And I tried to explain a very, very interesting observation about the way Libyan society reacted to this conquest, why the reaction of Libyan society varied from the eastern region to the western region to the southern region. And some resisted, some collaborated, some migrated, some were in between. And I tried to explain that and explain how that colonial period could be explained from a very much bottom-up perspective. And I observed that during the colonial period, the horrors of that intense and brutal period, and I continued to research that colonial history from the time I was a PhD student until now. This book that I started in 2000 really tried to examine and investigate one of the most terrible and violent cases in colonial Africa, which is the internment of over 110,000 people, civilians, in concentration camps before the Holocaust, and how the vast majority of them, two-thirds of them, perished in these camps. So I began that research in 2000, and I it took me almost literally, Jeff, 15 years to investigate what happened during that period, and why this case has been really dropped from modern scholarship, including forgotten genocide.
Thank you. You've touched on so much that we'll get into in some more depth. So thank you for providing that background. Going back to your own, being born in Libya, in your introduction to your book, you inform your readers that you're the grandson of anti-colonial resistors in Libya, and about your childhood and education in Libya and your college education and postgraduate education in Egypt and the United States, respectively. How did your life experiences influence your decision to write this book? And did it have any influence in your decision to research and write the book in the way that you did, focusing on archival and oral histories?
Well, that's a very good question, Jeff, because I think that the truth is that my parents and my grandparents brainwashed me. So when I was growing up as a kid in central and southern Libya, this is a... it was very peculiar period. I was born after independence in 1951, Libya became independent, constitutional monarchy, federal constitutional monarchy in 1951. And I was lucky that education became available. And my grandparents, I grew up in an extended family. My grandmother lived with us. And my parents, especially my grandparents, were in the same town. Their stories and there was no TV, there was no radio, and the stories and the oral narrative, and the poetry, and the fertile memory was really completely focused on what happened to them: starvation, famine, resistance, migration, exile, resistance, death and mourning during that colonial period. And I grew up with particularly two grandparents who both were active in the anti-colonial resistance. And my mother's, my maternal grandfather, Ali, took me under his wing, and he told me his life story almost 20 times. And my mother was born in exile. So I had a first encounter in my childhood to listen and to learn from them this oral alternative hidden history about the reaction to the colonial period, including the horrors of suffering, and also the fact that my grandfather, after the end of the resistance and its defeat, had to go into exile to escape execution, and the other one was hit by a group of Libyans in central Libya, and the family thought that he died until he appeared after independence 10 years later. The other grandfather migrated to a country called Chad under French control, and took refuge there. And my mother was born there. And when they, only after independence and the defeat of the fascists by the Allies, they came to Libya. And I came with that. So when I was born, Jeff, I grew up with all of this rich layers of communal, family, oral history that tried to really... Yeah, for survival and for maybe making sense of it, they kept it alive and they told the children. And I was one of the children who I was first born. And I really had two educations, public school education in Libya and after that college in Cairo. But I had a different cultural educational background, the oral and unrecorded history of ordinary people who were outside of the reach of the state, and they were in region that refused to be controlled by the central state, And those traditions of self-governing and autonomy and resisting colonialism influenced me a great deal. So when I came to University of Washington in Seattle, I learned English there. And after that, I learned Italian. I decided that I wanted to really give them justice, but also I wanted to learn what happened to my grandparents and what happened to my family and other families of their generation. And I began to investigate the colonial period, and I decided to to look at the archival records, oral history, field work, and that took me to study historical sociology, anthropology, and African history, and European history, and genocide studies. And I ended by becoming a multi or interdisciplinary scholar on the colonial period. And consumed my scholarly activities for the last 30 years. And I published three major monographs, The Making of Modern Libya, Forgotten Voices in 2005, and then my probably most ambitious work, which literally took 15 years, as I said, to investigate and research this forgotten genocide, but also not as isolated case, but also I wanted to see, link it to other African forgotten genocides and link it to intervene in the genocide studies in Europe and also in North America as a Libyan-American historian, historical sociologist, and political scientist.
It's really fascinating. I mean, it's remarkable, I think, in a way that you've been able to, it sounds like your intellectual and scholarly journal has also been a personal journey, and then also going beyond to anti-colonialism in some ways more broadly. It reminds me briefly of some research I did where I was looking at Security Council recognitions of genocide as, the permanent five members. And I believe when they were discussing Cambodia, there were a number of African countries that referred to colonialism as genocide, and it didn't really go anywhere and sort of fits into this maybe larger pattern of forgotten genocides. You can definitely feel free to comment on any of that. But I also wanted to ask you, you mentioned learning Italian. And I think that relates to a question I have for you about, any challenges and unique findings associated with your archival research. Was one of those challenges gaining access to Italian documents? Or I assume that's why you learned Italian specifically was to aid you in your research. But please feel free to answer that and comment on anything else.
The research was not as easy as anticipated. I am trained to as a political scientist, but also as a historical sociologist and historian. I knew that a good work requires patience and long time. One cannot just, produce a book quickly and assume that's going to be really contributing to knowledge and scholarship. So I'm used to doing three methods of investigating: archival research, like historians; oral history, like anthropologists; and also literary analysis of cultures like the Libyan culture, where poetry and oral traditions are the way a society communicate and the way society interact with each other. So this research was the hardest, Jeff, because I discovered two obstacles. First, theoretical, which is a Eurocentric colonial scholarship and categories that treats these things as sad cases or really wars, colonial wars that inevitable and that really doesn't really matter. The second thing is the fact that there was a cover-up in Italy and to a point in England regarding the secret and hidden history of Italian fascist and colonial history, and the fact that I discovered that this is really true when I came to the archives, and I encountered two specific cases. First, I was kicked out in 1989 with a lame excuse, self-serving, that I was a Libyan scholar, American, but I'm from Libya, originally from Libya, and Libyan government doesn't really allow Italian scholars to research in Libyan archives, which turned to be completely not true. And then after that, after trying again, I discovered that the Italian government not only refused to deal with the horrors and the brutality and the genocide in Libya, but also there was a cover up by removing the sensitive files on the archives and manipulating those files as well. And the reason I learned about that, after many years of trying to get access to these files, a very, very a progressive Italian historian by the name of Angelo Del Bocca wrote to me after I got really so frustrated with this. And he said, you know, Ali, I have spent 40 years researching the Italian archives. Don't waste your time, because I feel like, I think very, very, very much the case here, they either manipulated them or removed them because they are too embarrassing and sensitive. And that doesn't fit the idea of benign, moderate Italian fascism. So after that, I replied to him and I said, what should I do? He said, son, if I were you, you're young, you could do that. Go back and see if you could find the survivors in eastern Libya. So, Jeff, after finding that, I reached a dead end in this archives. And then I realized something also important later on, that some people still are naive and gullible about the archives. The archives are important, but archives reflect the narrative, the language, discourses of the dominant colonial powers or state powers and elites. And they're classified in a certain way, certain things included, certain things are excluded, certain things are glorified, certain things are completely ignored. And out of this, I began to think about, so there might be more to it than the archives. Then I discovered something even bigger, which is in England, for example, the BBC, very, very, very enlightened and conscientious producer by the name of King Kirby in 1998, made this 2 hours documentary film called Fascist Legacy. But after it's aired, the Italian government protested. They bought the rights of that video that exposed the atrocities and the genocide in Yugoslavia and Libya and also in Ethiopia. So they ended by buying that and shelving that film. I couldn't find it in the United States. And this is a BBC film that's supposed to be really for public consumption. Then I discovered who was behind it, what was in it. And it turned to be that a very courageous American historian by the name of Michael Bolompo was researching the same topic in the National Public Record Office in England, and he accidentally ran into and discovered a classified document that are not supposed to be open, and exposed the Allies' covering of the atrocities by the fascists, and that in Italy. And that brought a larger problem. There was no Nuremberg trials in Italy. The fascists were liked and needed to in the fight against Nazism, and the seeds of really covering up and producing a fictitious historiography and narrative that Italian fascism was benign, Italian fascism was moderate, and Italian people are refined, they have fine cuisine, fine architecture, we love Italy, and it can't be as nasty as the German culture and society that produced Nazism and the horrors of the Holocaust. So I began to investigate not only the dead end and the manipulation and the production of archives, but also the dominant theory and model of Italian fascism vis-a-vis German Nazism. And that informed me in a way, and I began to go every summer from 2000 until 2010 to Eastern Libya. And that became a very, very tough, hard journey, first to find the survivors. These are kids. They were kids when they were interned with their parents between 1929 and 1934 in the camps. And the they were 5 to 15 years old, and they still have memory of what happened. And it took a while to gain their trust and be able to find them and interview them. Now, your listeners, Jeff, need to understand there is a background. My people might say, so what happened? Why people are interned? First, we have to understand two things. The first point, Italian conquest in 1911, October 1911, was very, very much assumed that they would be against Ottoman control. They will modernize Libya. They began to have that propaganda. But they faced a very, very well-organized societal resistance based on volunteers and volunteer armies. And that resistance took 20 years. That stiff resistance posed a threat to the Italians, especially the fascists in 1922, who had a design. They want to empty Eastern Libya and Libya as a colony, the foreshore, to settle poor peasants of Italy, between 500,000, some estimate 1 million, in Libya. So after they faced that resistance, they came with draconian, really genocidal, racist policy. They, to suffocate that resistance, they moved, they had a fence along the Egyptian borders, and then they decided to do something so horrific and violent. Prior to the Holocaust, I always argue this is the Holocaust before the Holocaust. They moved between 100 and 110,000 people, children, women, and elderly, on foot or by sea to the desert of central Libya. And also they moved 600,000 animals, the herds of those nomads and semi-nomads, and put them in 16 concentration camps. The four camps that I investigated and researched for 10 years were the brutal camps where most of the death took place. And between 1929, those 110,000 who were entered there, only one third of them came alive in 1934. And that really became another revelation, another discovery for me. And I began to really pay attention to the archival research, but mostly the narrative and the testimonies of the survivors, where the book began to take a character of its own, writing the history of this forgotten genocide from the perspectives of those survivors. It took a decade, Jeff, because it really was that difficult. It was that really hard to decipher. And I decided I don't want to produce something out of 5 years. I want to be patient. I want to learn. I want to see what really happened to this collective crime, and also see how the scholarship, the nationalist, the Eurocentric, the modern scholarship, either commented on it or ignored it or tried to really deny it in the first place. And then I spent 5 years trying to really, you know, examine, verify the evidence, you know, see what's really reliable or not. And out of it, after 15 years, came this new book, Genocide in Libya, Sharr, A Hidden Colonial History.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Which is an excellent book that I hope all of our listeners will eventually at some point get the time to read it. Once you gain the trust of the people you interviewed, the survivors of concentration camps, did you get an idea, or maybe since then, have you got an idea how they feel about, the research and its purposes, and, how were you affected by this research and talking to these survivors? And were there any concerns about their well-being? Were there any ethical concerns with the research that you did?
That's an excellent question, Jeff. I actually, I became very, very aware of this question. So to the point that I even wrote a whole chapter that you, I'm glad that you read the whole book, and I try to examine and tell what happened there. And I think your listeners will probably be interested in remembering this. When I went there, I wanted to listen and also tell the story of the genocide from their own perspective, what they have to say to me. But it turned to be, it wasn't as easy. When I, the wonderful, generous people who are my friends in the Boy Scouts, in high school education, in sports, in college in Cairo, all from Eastern Libya, all helped me. And what helped me also, two things, that my grandmother is from Eastern Libya, and some of her members were interned too. The second thing is, when I went to see them, I was very intrigued, but also pleasantly surprised. They investigated me, or they really interviewed me before I could interview them. Some of them, they say, "Who are you? Who are your parents? Who are your grandparents? Why are you doing this research? What are you going to do with this research?" And I loved it because it meant that they are conscientious. They were clear about what they went through, and their parents and grandparents. They were creed. They were aware of the genocidal policy against them. And it really brought to me something scholars brush aside and just they go and research and they find their own results and they publish them. And one of them told me, and his son told me, "Professor, are you living and teaching in America?" I said, "Yes." "You were educated in America?" I said, "Yes." And they said to me, "What are you going to do with our research? Are you going to just write our stories and then write a book and get all the credit for you and use us as a material for your own prestige?" And I said, no, I'm willing to listen. And I assure you that when I finish this book, I'm going to try to translate it into Arabic, and I'll send you copies of it, so you'll make sure that's the case. And then they asked me, when they asked me about my grandparents, and they realized that they were also in the anti-colonial resistance. And I'm also something very interesting. In Libya, people talk about communal and background. So they asked me, "Where are you from?" I said, "I am from Wadan." And then some of them, I said, "Are you from the Ashrafs?" I said, "Yes." Ashrafs are Muslims or Arabs who trace their descendants and genealogy from the Prophet Muhammad's family. So that gave me a lot of mileage there with them. And the fact that both my grandparents were in the resistance gave me another credentials in their eyes. And that my grandmother was from Eastern Libya, from a resisting family as well, that calmed them down. And then after that, when they opened to me, Jeff, they not only began to talk to me openly, they even gave me rare photos, rare drawings They gave me also poems that composed during the time of internment. And also they began to tell me, introduce me to other survivors. And that took literally 10 years. So I feel like I think my grandparents and my they should be happy in their graves that I try to be very thorough and very, very faithful. But at the same time, Jeff, I was very clear. I don't want to write another nationalistic, condemnation or so. I wanted to be aware that the nation state in Libya, under the monarchy and under Gaddafi, they used and appropriated this horrible, brutal history for their own ends. So I wanted to write something that's not only about thinking and putting together this collective social hidden history, but also I wanted to look at other African cases, and above all, I wanted to write a transnational, transcultural monograph that also intervene and introduce this case to genocide studies in Europe and our debates in the United States. In other words, what I wanted to do is not only to put together the narrative and the history of this forgotten genocide that nobody knows about it, and still I will claim few people know about it, but also I wanted to make sure that how to explain the silence, the denial, the cover-up, and lack of evidence, and bring that issue to contemporary politics and contemporary situation in Libya, in Italy, and also I investigated our own reception in the United States through the New York Times, the National Geographic magazine, our scholarship on benign and moderate fascism, and our movies and Hollywood representations of that. So I tried to make it a very ambitious, relevant monograph about not just the past, but also the history of the present and its very multiple layers and multiple connections. And above all, I really wanted to make this case visible to non-Libyans, but at the same time, intervene in the debate about Eurocentric study of genocide by saying that the Holocaust has roots in Africa. The Holocaust has brought maybe the other way around, brought what happened in the colonies to Europe itself. And also, to my shock, I discovered something completely new in that regard. The German Nazi state and officials were fascinated and impressed by how successful the genocide of over 70,000, 80,000 outside the camps, as also in eastern Libya, as a model to the German Nazi state later on. And I had no idea about that. I ran into that by accident. This is something probably I could tell you more about it if you would like.
For sure. I mean, the one sort of common quote that's attributed to Hitler about previous genocides points to the Armenian genocide, right? No one who remembers the Armenians, or yes. I forget the exact quote. Yeah, the case of Libya does not come in to the same context when talking about sort of precursors or lessons learned for the Jewish Holocaust. So we can definitely come to that. I also want to get to this question of forgotten genocides and labeling, and in genocide studies, cases and labeling is quite contentious. There's been conflict and debate among scholars, and a primary area for contestation is the question of genocidal intent and the distinguish between war or conflict and genocide. Because there was anti-colonial resistance in Libya and a counterinsurgency. Do you think this explains why some members of the international community, whether scholarly or otherwise, and notably in the West, don't recognize Italy's violence against Libyans as genocide? Would they argue that the intent was not there?
Well, there are two ways to answer this question. First of all, Raphael Lemkin, the brilliant visionary Jewish Polish legal scholar who is the father of modern genocide studies, he identified the very particular point that you're asking, Jeff. He said that for genocide to to be acknowledged, you have to have intentionality and also the destruction of social, political, physical, and cultural life. And some scholars get the two things when they debate these things. We have layers that say, you are aware of it, that the Holocaust was unique. And you cannot be compared. And there are some scholars who say that because of the horrors and the intensity and the number. But I think number is really, it shouldn't be the case. In the case of Libya, I discovered that there was letters that stated exactly the bad fate and the intention where the three generals, Dubono, Bedelio, and the general who executed that plan, Rodolfo Graziani, they stated that very, very much the case. We are a modern state. Libya belongs to us, our foreshore. We are coming back. We are the heirs of the Roman Empire, and our people have to breathe and settle. And if these Bedouin, if these nomads, these undisciplined people, if they don't really come to terms with our intention, it's okay. And we're going to be very, very, very firm to the point of if that leads to the extermination of the whole population, so be it. So in terms of intentionality, if people get judicious about this, we discover evidence for this. And that's really... this is really the first point. The second point is the Libyan genocide, because of the intentionality and the destruction of the 70,000 people, and the fact that Libya lost at least 1/3 of its population. Just to give you an idea, Libya, according to Ottoman census in the year 1908, 1910, had 1 to 1.5 million. In 1943, only 800,000 people, were recorded at that time living in Libya, which, by the way, it used to be called Tripoli. Libya is a name that the Italian revived from the Roman period. So the first thing is you need to understand that this is really a very, very manipulative argument, and instead of really recognizing that if people have the same worth, if we respect people and not other them, or look at them as victims of progress and civilization and modernization, as the colonial ideology usually addresses, especially in settler colonial states. And if we take the others as equal and societies as living cultures, then there is no escape to recognize other Holocausts and other genocides. And I think in that sense, it's very obvious to me that this is a case of genocide. Not only is it a very major genocide, it's horrific because it occurred, it's the first major genocide after the Herero and the Armenian genocides after World War I. It's the first major one, and it was prior to the Holocaust. So its progressivity, it's really a connection with the Holocaust is really huge. And here, and instead of talking about the conflict between Jews and Muslims, we are talking about Jews, Gypsies, other groups, and Libyan Muslims who were both victims of fascist genocides. And we have to keep in mind that Italy is among a few fascist countries that had genocides in the 20th century. The German, they had colonies earlier. So in that sense, this is really... in terms of empirical evidence, oral history breaks new grounds. And in terms of theorizing and making connections and trying to make sense of this really horrible case and its oral history, it tried to raise a new question about old topics and making new connections that goes beyond Eurocentrism, colonial knowledge, and also the nation itself as a unit of thinking about genocide. And in that sense, I wanted to provincialize Europe, not only in one sense, but also bring the other connections that was exposed and advocated by other scholars from Hannah Arendt to Mike Davis to Mahmoud Mamdani, to Jim Scott, and also other scholars who try to really give alternative way of thinking, alternative theorizing of genocide. It's not a coincidence, Jeff, that we have now made quite leap forward as far our understanding of forgotten genocide in Australia, in Africa, in the Middle East, in Latin America, and I hope that in our own United States we recognize even fully the native genocides. But unfortunately, even the new books on a forgotten genocide did not include the Libyan case. So I feel very, very glad that I, as a scholar, as an American Libyan scholar, I was able in these 15 years to really salvage that hidden history before it was too late, because most of the survivors now are either dead or senile. And in that sense, the Libyan case, could have been forgotten. And I have to say, up until recently, the Italian official silence over this genocide and the fact that nobody knew about it. When I go to many, many universities, I ask people the same question, and you will be surprised, nobody knew about it. They say, Ali, was there any concentration camps in Libya? So I think I feel like being an American academic allowed me to the patience and the independence to spend this decade to try to put together and figure out the riddles and the puzzles of this case, why it happened, how it happened, and why it disappeared from modern scholarship. And the book maybe will contribute to your listeners and to the readers something as big of a crime as the genocide in Libya, which is as big as the Herero genocide in the turn of the 20th century, the Congo genocide that also we often forget about it, and the violence in Algeria. So these are the four nasty cases that we need to kind of keep in mind. And Hannah Arendt was visionary and brilliant in stating in 1951 that to understand what went on in Europe, the horrors of totalitarian regimes and genocide, we have to look back in Africa. But a lot of people forgot about that observation. And then at the few books and conferences that try to think about it, they try to really turn it to a posturing, a very, very much quotations or dismissal thing. So I'm very, very much, strong in my, thinking and my argument about it's time for us to confront these models and these silences. And that will enable us to discover and humanize the others, including the Libyan people who face this horrific experience. And one of the worst things for me, Jeff, was to, after I'd done all of the oral research among the survivors and did all of the research in three languages and three continents about the archival evidence, I decided to take my camera and take... and go to the archives, to the location of these camps, the four camps I researched. And I was horrified because the one thing that really shocked me and really made me very, very, very disturbed is the sight of thousands of graves, collective mass graves and singular graves and at the Agela, and at the Brega concentration camps. And I came face to face with death and the genocide. One last point also important for the listeners to keep in mind, that the destruction, the people were not gassed, even though the Italian fascists used gas first in 1929 in Libya and 1935 in Ethiopia, which also, of course, the Nazis took to a higher level of genocidal policies. But what I discovered that when I asked the survivors, why so many people perish in the camps? And they said, son, we died because of shar. And then shar in Arabic means evil. But in this particular Libyan culture means starvation or hunger first. In this particular experience, they meant that they were not fed. They were giving a little bit of barley. And when they got sick, they were not treated. So the vast majority, the two-thirds of them, the 70,000 people there, especially the elderly and children and the sick ones, died because of diseases. And add to that, these are hardworking, self-sufficient people. They have their agriculture, their herds, and their animals. Most of the herds, 6,000 of them, either confiscated or died as well because they were they wanted to starve the population. So this horrible, really violent history made me understand what happened at least. And at the same time, it allowed me to see the resistance, the resilience, the awareness that they were facing very, very genocidal policies, but also the ability to compose poetry, to keep the memory alive and record and teach the children and the grandchildren about it, which amazed me. And I began to understand there is a culture within a culture. There is a modern Libyan culture, and there is oral, poetic, communal culture that existed beyond the national state and the national elite of Libya. And understanding that language, that vocabulary, that poetry, those poems allowed me to really understand how they reacted culturally and socially, and how they kept that memory fertile and alive until today.
And were these social and cultural responses part of the healing and reparative process?
Yes, absolutely, Jeff. You got it right. I think by remembering those stories, it helped them stay alive, expressing themselves to the point that one of the elderly folks whom I interviewed, and I methodologically, I tried to be reflexive and to be really aware of it. I'll interview some of them more than once to see if the narrative and the oral history has been changed or not. But one of them told me, listen, son, we died because of shar and marad, means starvation and diseases. But without talking about it, we will die alive. And I took that quote and put it at the beginning of one of my chapters because I think by keeping that memory alive, they were able to heal. They were able to remember their humanity and their agency and their voices and kept it going. And I talked with them. I said, what should we do now? What should we do with this? They said, son, first we need you to tell us our stories. And I promised them to do this. But I didn't get any sense of calling for vengeance or retribution or so. They said the most important thing for us, not the money, not the reparation. We want just the world to understand what happened to us because it looks nobody paid attention to us. And I talked with one of the children of these young men and women. And one older lady, she really, I still have her recording. She will sing to me, one moment she will cry and tell me what happened to us. And also another moment will sing to me. And I was so, taken by this scene when I listened to these interviews twice, three times, four times, five times, just to understand what they're saying and how they are saying it. So I think this communal memorization and recitation of the poetry, of the narrative, of the names, became a way of healing and really remembering what happened to them. And thank God, I was lucky with the support of really good people in Eastern Libya, good people in Italy too, the people who believed in my research in my own university, University of New England, here in Maine, who supported me, my students. I began to really realize that And to the point that I don't just do that research. I teach courses related to my comparative genocide and forgotten genocides. And my undergraduate students are delightful because they keep asking about this. And I even teach a course called Empire and Genocide, Jeff. And you know, it's a full course. I have a waiting list in this. And I tease my students. I said, you know, what's wrong with you guys? Who wants to study some as horrible thing as genocide? And they smile. So this is I think, a way for people to keep it alive. And I have to also to add one more point, Jeff. While this has been really almost kind of depressed me, and I told a friend of mine in Spain, I almost my soul comes out because it was so hard and so painful. I have to say, my colleagues, when I was invited to give talks in our many, many leading universities in after the publication of my book, Forgotten Voices, people were very open. They didn't know much about the case, but they would say, tell us more about it. They were, you know, very eager and all said, yeah, we hope that you finish this work. But my, I couldn't finish this research without the support of my own students, our own library, the people in Eastern Libya, some friends in Italy and in England. And I'm just, you know, so glad that I did not rush this research because easily one could get tired. One could say, you know, you want to have a life. My two young kids who are in college now, they complain to me all the time. I really drove them nuts because day and night I'm in my basement calling people, researching. And when I went to Eastern Libya, I remember they laughed at me because the Libyan Studies Center, which did a remarkable job in collecting oral history under the supervision of Professor Jan Van Sina, who was the advisor for Professor Mohammad Jarrari in Tripoli, I decided to ask my own questions, including what did they feed you, what kind of clothes they do you have any clothes, and they used to laugh at me. They say, you know, Ali, these are very American questions. I said, no, you guys are wrong. These are real questions. You forgot to ask the people about them because they made a lot of sense. Of course, many of the colleagues there, they are historians, and that's the other lesson, Jeff. We have to have multidisciplinary or collaborative work to produce something holistic and important. And I think I discovered that my political science alone degree and training was not enough. I discovered my training in historical sociology was not enough. I discovered that that my anthropology courses and reading and methods really helped me. And after that, and above all, I had to learn for 3 years how to understand oral traditions, non-material expression and communication, the way people interact and express themselves in a different way. And only by understanding these unconventional multidisciplinary sources, I began to understand discover the larger picture, but also I became very, very, very convinced that the Cold War categories, the area studies division of European studies, of African studies, of Sub-Saharan studies, of they are really are an obstacle more than empowering us to understand and produce a new knowledge. If you just focus on European studies and forget about North Africa as alone, or if you look at the Sahara as a divide, an empty space between Northern Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, it makes no sense. I advocated in this book a new way of thinking, a new epistemology against the canons of the area studies and the canons of the Cold War, by advocating that we need to kind of look at the interconnections and between these countries. And I argued that you cannot understand Europe without understanding Africa and Asia. We cannot understand Italy without understanding Libya and Ethiopia and Eritrea, for that matter, or France without looking at Algeria, and vice versa. And we could say also us and the United States, we need to see these connections, not because we want to be nice or understand something benevolent, but this is history is really, the history is of the present is what we are after. But also we need to really be aware that the area studies will be an obstacle more than allowing us to discover these connections, discover these interdependence. And the fact, I argued that in Italy and also in many, many of my talks, there is no way one can understand modern Libya without understanding Italy. And you cannot understand Italy without looking at the Libyan case. So that's, I would say, the new methodology, a new wisdom going forward in the 21st century. We cannot cling to these old epistemologies and canons and assumptions and unit of analysis. Of course, that will encompass also the idea of a nation state as a unit of analysis. And there are things that are goes beyond modern nation states. And when we confront them, it will liberate us. It will allow us to have a new work, not only about Libya itself, but Libya as a case among many, and allow us to explore liberating social sciences that will build more bridges, will build more knowledge than the idea of everybody in their own.
Yeah, and in your conclusion, you actually say, quote, a transnational, or you make a call for a, quote, transnational and comparative critical paradigm that engages not only subaltern voices, but examines the silence of an empire, colonial genocides, and the political theory associated with them. Looking beyond Libya, and you've touched on this already a little bit, but what do you think scholars might come to see that they have not already if they were to engage in such a paradigm?
Well, Jeff, listen, we have to break the silence and denial. Empire matters. Colonialism matters. Colonialism does not end by independence. Colonialism in the colonies and also in the colonizing countries did not end then. The minute we rehabilitate, bring back categories that we tend to ignore, allow us to not only see the realities and the dynamics that are with us, but also confront the history of racism, of dehumanizing others, of the use and abuse of things like modernization, progress, civilization, and also deal with power and language. I think we have to understand that these ideas are used to really justify and legitimize empire, domination, and yes, including genocide. Unless we confront the silences and the blind spots in our social sciences and our assumptions, I think we will really miss what happened in reality. We have to keep in mind, we inherited the social sciences from the 19th century, the age of empire and colonialism. And I think those social sciences were silent. They were really a part of the larger context, including big wigs like Max Weber, like the European scholars who influence our social sciences. So I think it's about time that we look critically at the knowledge and power as interconnected. Knowledge is not always neutral. Knowledge is really produced by social, economic, and institutional settings, directly or indirectly. And now we have an opportunity to re-examine the failing of colonial knowledge, the persistence of colonial knowledge, Cold War scholarship, and also the area studies as really a variation that did not confront the ghosts of the past, because the ghosts of the past will be with us whether we like it or not. And imagine, Jeff, what kind of society we'll have to deal with imagine that us in the United States, where we ignore empire, we ignore domination, we ignore genocide in our own history. And imagine when we confront these issues, what kind of liberating possibilities that would be for all of us. So I think I make a big deal out of this. This is really the larger lessons of the empirical history. That's why I refuse to be pushed back to say, oh, this is a Libyan case. Let's look at it from African perspective. Oh, it's a sad case about colonial wars. And after all, they say to me, some people who are really still entrenched in that, didn't Italian colonialism also brought science and medicine and education to some people? I would say to them, and exterminated almost one third or half of the population. The idea that colonialism, especially settler colonialism, as modernizing, is an ideological construction that refused to treat the other as a human being.
Thank you, Ali. Yeah, reckoning with our, by our, I guess I could be speaking about the United States, but maybe larger, the Western world. It'd be without acknowledging and reckoning with our past, how can we possibly expect us, the policies to change in the future? And that's, one of the things, an argument I make. I have a book on the United States and genocide, and looking at the U.S. relationship with Indonesia in the mid-60s, Guatemala, Pakistan, et cetera. These things aren't talked about as being like complicit in genocide or conspiring in the case of Indonesia in genocide, or the history of treatment of indigenous peoples in the United States. And if we don't acknowledge what we actually did, I just don't see how we can expect those policies to change in the future. And that's where we see persistent racism or arming Saudi Arabia with what it's doing in Yemen. Like, these things, they don't change if we don't talk about them and see them for what they are. So thank you for this incredible contribution.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I really enjoyed the conversation with you, and I'm very grateful for the fact that you approached me and you read my book. That's the best thing I could hear from anybody, and I enjoyed our conversation very much.
Thank you. And before we do let you go, is there anything, are you working on anything new? Is there anything connected to this book, another part of this project?
I'm exhausted now, but I think, as I promised the survivors, is I'm going to try when I recover my energy and hopefully we'll have a vaccine to survive this pandemic. I would like to every weekend maybe translate the book, because it's really, as I hate to give it to somebody who doesn't understand the multi-layers perspectives on this. So I'm going to try to do that. And there is a temptation to do a follow-up that I'm, to the book. Many, many people are asking me to do that, but I promised my two kids, they both are in college, that next subject is going to be a lighter one. So I want to cling to maybe to them, to that idea that I might work in Egyptian cinema and film. Just a lighter topic than genocide, but I guess that's to be seen, Jeff.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ali. Get your rest, and maybe we'll talk again in the future.
I would love to. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you, Jeff. Thank you very much again.
Thank you. Take care.